from KUER News in Salt Lake City, I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot of anxiety that moves through your body in that 27 seconds it takes your kid or your loved one to make their way through the wrapping paper on your holiday gift. You'll know right away if you scored. There's that nanosecond of true expression revealed in their face. And that tells you everything. But the real value of most gifts emerges days, sometimes months later, when you see them being put to use. Not just played with, but adapted into their lives. When you see the pen settled into a shirt pocket, the brooch at home on her sweater. It's harder to measure, but the same thing can be said for the enduring value of a gift that was a piece of art, or a book of poetry, or a story. It's hard to figure out sizes and colors for several thousand public radio listeners, so our gift to you for this holiday season, from those of us at KUER and Radio West, is a story. Two stories, actually. Today in the program, we're hoping you can set aside the next hour and just listen. Here, we'll stall for a minute while you get settled. This is Radio West. The characters in Ron Carlson stories have been described as mostly regular folk, good, decent people who confront situations that are, if not completely extraordinary, different enough to get them wondering about their lives. Carlson is an emeritus English professor from Arizona State University, and his stories have appeared in The New Yorker and Harper's. You've heard his stuff on This American Life with Ira Glass. Ron grew up in Salt Lake City, went to West High School, and lived here for a time in the Avenues. That's where he got the inspiration for his first Christmas story.
I'd been a teacher and a writer all these years, and I was writing stories, and I ran into our old friend Karen Shepherd, who was at that time the editor of Network, the monthly magazine in Salt Lake, and she said, "I've got a challenge for you. Why don't you write a Christmas story?" So I took the challenge, and I wrote this story, which has, some years ago, which has gone on. I'm very gratified that it's had many lives and incarnations. I love Salt Lake so much, and it's been a glorious story for me. I'm so glad that I wrote it. I meant every word. I think I still do.
And here it is, Ron Carlson's story, The H Street Sledding Record. It's read by the actor Tobin Atkinson.
The last thing I do every Christmas Eve is go out in the yard and throw the horse manure onto the roof. It is a ritual. After we return from making our attempt at the H Street sledding record, and we sit in the kitchen sipping eggnog and listening to Elise recount the sled ride, and Elise then finally goes to bed happily, reluctantly, and we finish placing Elise's presents under the tree, and we pin her stocking to the mantel with care, and Drew brings out two other wrap boxes, which anyone could see are for me, and I slap my forehead, having forgotten to get her anything at all for Christmas, except the prizes hidden behind the glider on the front porch. I go into the garage and put on the gloves, and then into the yard where I throw the horse manure on the roof. Drew always uses this occasion to call my mother. They exchange all the Christmas news, but the main purpose of the calls the last few years has been for Drew to stand in the window where she can see me out there lobbing the great turds up into the snow on the roof and describe what I'm doing to my mother. The two women take amusement from this. They say things like, "You married him," and "He's your son." I take their responses to my rituals as a kind of fond, subtle support, which it is. Drew has said, when she first discovered me throwing the manure on the roof, the Christmas that Elise was for, "You're the only man I've ever known who did that." See? A compliment. But now that Elise is 8, Drew has become cautious. "You're fostering her fantasies." I answer, "Kids grow up too soon these days." And then Drew has this, "What do you want her to do? Come home from school in tears when she's 15? Some kid in her class will have said, 'Oh, sure, Santa's reindeer shit on your roof, eh?'" All I can say to Drew then is, "Some kid in her class? Fine. I don't care what he says. I'm her father." I have thrown horse manure on our roof for 4 years now, and I plan to do it every Christmas until my arm gives out. It satisfies me as a homeowner to do so, for the wonderful amber stain that is developing between the swamp cooler and the chimney and is visible all spring, summer, fall as you drive down the hill by our house, and for the way the two rose bushes by the gutter spout have raged into new and profound growth during the milder months. And as a father, it satisfies me as a ritual that keeps my family together. Drua said, "You want to create evidence? Let's put out milk and a cookie and then drink the milk and eat a bite out of the cookie." I look at her. "Drew," I had said, "I don't like cookies. I never ate a dessert in my life." And like I said, Drew's been a good sport. Even the year I threw one gob short and ran a hideous smear down the kitchen window screen that hovered over all of us until March, when I was able to take it down and go to the car wash. I obtained the manure from my friend Bob, more specifically from his horse, Power, who lives just west of Heber. I drive out there the week before Christmas and retrieve about a bushel. I throw it on the roof a lump at a time, wearing a pair of welding gloves my father gave me. I put the brake on the sled in 1975 when Drew was pregnant with Elise, so we could still make our annual attempt on the 8th Street record on Christmas Eve. It was the handle of a broken Louisville Slugger baseball bat, and it still had the precise 34 stamped into the bottom. I sawed it off square and drilled and bolted it to the rear of the sled so that when I pulled back on it, the stump would drag us to a stop. As it turned out, it was one of the 2 years when there was no snow, so we walked up to 11th Avenue and H Street, as we promised, rain or shine, sat on the flexible flyer in the middle of a dry street on a starry Christmas Eve, and I held her in my lap. We sat on the sled like two basketball players contesting possession of her belly. We talked a little about what it would be like when she took her leave from the firm and I had her home all day with the baby, and we talked remotely about whether we wanted any more babies, and we talked about the record, which was set on December 24, 1969, the first Christmas of our marriage, when we lived in the neighborhood on Fifth Avenue in an old barn of a house, the total rent on which was $72.50, honest, and Drew had given me the sled that very night, and we had walked out about midnight and been surprised by the blizzard. No wonder we took the sled and walked around the corner up H Street, up, up, up to 11th Avenue, and without speaking or knowing what we were doing, opening the door on the second ritual of our marriage, the annual sled ride. The first ritual was the word condition and the activities it engendered in our droopy old bed. At the top, we scanned the city blurred in snow, sat on my brand new Christmas sled, and set off. The sled rode high and effortlessly through the deep snow, and suddenly, as our hearts started and our eyes began to burn against the snowy air, we were going faster than we'd planned. We crossed 10th Avenue, nearly taking flight in the dip, and then descended in a dark rush, 9th, 8th, 7th, soaring across each avenue, my arms wrapped around Drew like a straitjacket to drag her off with me if a car should cross in front of us on 6th, 5th Avenue, 4th, this all took seconds, you see, until a car did turn onto H Street, headed our way, and we veered the new sled sharply up over the curb, dousing our speed in the snowy yard, one house from the corner of 3rd Avenue. Drew took a real face full of snow, which she squirmed around and pressed into my neck, saying the words, "Now that's a record!" And it was the record. 11th to 3rd, and it stood partly because there had been two Christmas Eves with no snow, partly because of assorted spills brought on by too much speed, too much laughter, sometimes too much caution, and by a light blue Mercedes that crossed 6th Avenue just in front of us in 1973. And though some years were flops, there was nothing about Christmas that Elise looked forward to as much as our one annual attempt at the H Street sledding record. I think Drew wants another baby. I'm not sure, but I think she wants another child. The signs are so subtle they barely seem to add up, but she says things like, "Remember before Elise went to school?" and There sure are a lot of women in their mid-30s having babies. I should ask her. But for some reason, I don't. We talk about everything. Everything. But I've avoided this topic. I've avoided talking to Drew about this topic because I want another child too badly to have her not want one. I want a little boy to come into the yard on Christmas morning and say, "See, there on the roof, the reindeers were there." I want another kid to throw horse manure for. I'll wait. It will come up one of these days. I'll find a way to bring it up. Christmas is coming. Every year, on the day after Halloween, I tip the sled out of the rafters in the garage and Elise and I sponge it off, clean the beautiful dark blonde wood with furniture polish, enamel the nicked spots on the runner supports with black engine paint, and rub the runners themselves with waxed paper. It is a ritual done on the same plaid blanket in the garage, and it takes all afternoon. When we are finished, we lean the sled against the wall, and Elise marches into the house. "Okay now," she says to her mother, "let it snow!" On the first Friday night in December every year, Elise and Drew and I go by our tree. This, too, is a ritual. Like those families that bundle up and head for the wilderness so they can trudge through the deep, pristine snow, chop down their own little tree and drag it step by step all the way home, we venture forth in the same spirit. Only we take the old pickup down to South State and find some joker who has thrown up two strings of colored lights around the corner of a parking lot of a burned-out Safeway and is proffering trees to the general public. There is something magical and sad about this little forest just sprung up across from City Tacos, and Drew and Elise and I wander the wooded paths, waiting for some lopsided pinion to leap into our hearts. The winter Drew and I became serious when I was a senior and she was already in her first year at law school, I sold Christmas trees during vacation. I answered a card on a dorm bulletin board and went to work for a guy named Gear who had cut 2,000 squat pinions from the hills east of Cedar City and was selling them from a dirt lot on Redwood Road. Drew's mother invited me to stay with them for the holidays, and it gave me the chance to help Drew make up her mind about me. I would sell trees until midnight with Gear, and then drive back to Drew's and watch every old movie in the world and wrestle with Drew until our faces were mashed blue. I wanted to complicate things wonderfully by having her sleep with me. She wanted to keep the couch cushions between us and think it over. It was a crazy Christmas. We'd steam up the windows in the entire living room, but she never gave in. We did develop the joke about condition, which we still use as a code word for desire. And later, I won't say if it was the spring or fall, when Drew said to me, "I'd like to see you about this condition," I knew everything was going to be all right and we'd spend every Christmas together for the rest of our lives. One night during that period, I delivered a tree to University Village, the married students' housing off Sunnyside. The woman was waiting for me with the door open as I dragged the pine up the steps to the second floor. She was a girl, really, about 20, and her son, about 3, watched the arrival from behind her. When I had the tree squeezed into the apartment, she asked if I could just hold it for a minute while she found her tree stand. "If you ever need to stall for a couple of hours, just say you're looking for your tree stand." I mean, the girl was gone for about 20 minutes. I stood and exchanged stares with the kid, who was scared. He didn't understand why some strange man had brought a tree into his home. "Christmas," I told him. "Christmas? Can you say Merry Christmas?" I was an idiot. When the girl returned with her tree stand, she didn't seem in any hurry to set it up. She came over to me and showed me the tree stand, holding it up for an explanation as to how it worked. Close up, the girl's large eyes had an odd look in them, and then I understood it when she leaned through the boughs and kissed me. It was a great move, I had to hand it to her. There I was, holding the tree. I couldn't make a move either way. It has never been among my policies to kiss strangers, but I held the kiss and the tree. Something about her eyes. She stepped back with the sweetest look of embarrassment and hope on her face that I'd ever seen. "Just loosen the turn screws in the side of that stand," I said finally, "and we can put this tree up." By the time I had the tree secured, she had returned again with a box of ornaments, lights, junk like that, and I headed for the door. "Thanks," I said. "Merry Christmas." Her son had caught on by now and was fully involved in unloading the ornaments. The girl looked up at me, and this time I saw it all. Her husband coming home with his cap and gown last June saying, "Thanks for law school, honey, but I met Doris at the jurisprudence ball, and I gotta be me. Keep the kid." The girl said to me, "You could stay and help." It seemed like two statements to me, and so I answered them separately. "Thank you. But I can't stay. That's the best help. Have a good Christmas." And I left them there together, decorating that tree, a ritual against the cold. "How do you like it?" Elise says to me. She has selected a short, broad bush, which seems to have grown in two directions at once and then given up. She sees the look on my face and says, "If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Besides, I've already decided this is the tree for us." "It's a beautiful tree," Drew says. "Quasimodo," I whisper to Drew. "This tree's name is Quasimodo." "No whispering," Elise says from behind us. "What's he saying now, Mom?" "He said he likes the tree too." Elise is not convinced, and after a pause, she says, "Dad, it's Christmas. Behave yourself." When we go to pay for the tree, the master of ceremonies is busy negotiating a deal with two kids, a punk couple. The tree man stands with his hands in his change apron and says, "I gotta get $35 for that tree." The boy, a skinny kid in a leather jacket, shrugs and says he's only got $28. His girlfriend, a large person with a bowl haircut and a monstrous black overcoat festooned with buttons, is wailing, "Please, oh no, Jimmy. Jimmy, I love that tree. I want that tree." The tree itself stands aside, a noble pine of about 12 feet. Unless these kids live in a gymnasium, they're buying a tree bigger than their needs. Jimmy retreats to his car, an old Plymouth big as a boat. "Police rule" is spray-painted across both doors in balloon letters. He returns instantly and opens a handful of coins. "I'll give you $31.55 and my watch." To our surprise, the wily tree man takes the watch to examine it. When I see that, I give Elise $4 and tell her to give it to Kid Jimmy and say Merry Christmas. His girlfriend is still wailing, but now a minor refrain of "Oh Jimmy, that tree, oh Jimmy, etc." I haven't seen a public display of emotion and longing of this magnitude in Salt Lake City ever. I watch Elise give the boy the money, but instead of saying Merry Christmas, I hear her say instead, "Here, Jimmy, Santa says keep your watch." Jimmy pays for the tree, and his girl, and this is the truth, jumps on him, wrestles him to the ground in gratitude, and smothers him for nearly a minute. There have never been people happier about a Christmas tree. We pay quickly and head out before Jimmy or his girlfriend can think to begin thanking us. On the way home in the truck, I say to Elise, "Santa says keep your watch, eh?" "Yes, he does," she smiles. "How old are you, anyway?" 8. It's an old joke, and Drew finishes it for me. "When he was your age, he was 7. We will go home, and while the two women begin decorating the tree with the artifacts of our many Christmases together, I will thread popcorn onto a long string. It is a ritual I prefer for its uniqueness. The fact that once a year I get to sit and watch the two girls I am related to move about a tree inside our home while I sit nearby and sow food. On the morning of the 24th of December, Elise comes into our bedroom already dressed for sledding. Good news, she says. We've got a shot at the record. Drew rises from the pillow and peeks out the blind. It's snowing, she says. Christmas Eve, we drive back along the snowy avenues and park on Fifth, as always. I know, Elise says, hopping out of the car. You two used to live right over there before you had me, and it was a swell place and only cost $72.50 a month, honest. Drew looks at me and smiles. How old are you? I ask Elise, but she is busy towing the sled away, around the corner, up toward 11th Avenue. It is still snowing, petal flakes teeming by the street lamps, trying to carry the world away. I take Drew's hand, and we walk up the middle of 8th Street behind our daughter. There is no traffic, but the few cars have packed the tender snow perfectly. It could be a record. On 9th Avenue, Drew stops me in the intersection, the world still as snow, and kisses me. I love you, she says. What a planet, I whisper, to allow such a thing. By the time we climb to 11th Avenue, Elise is seated on the sled, ready to go. What are you guys waiting for? Christmas? She says, and then laughs at her own joke. Then she becomes all business. Listen, Dad, I figure if you stay just a little to the left of the tire tracks, we could go all the way, and no wobbling. She's referring to last year's record attempt, which was extinguished in the 8th Avenue block when we laughed ourselves into a fatal wobble and ended in a slush heap. We arrange ourselves on the sled as we have each Christmas Eve for 8 years. As I reach my long legs around these two women, I sense their excitement. It's going to be a record, Elise whispers into the whispering snow. Do you think so? Drew asks. She also feels this could be the night. Oh yeah, Elise says. The conditions are perfect. What do you think? Drew turns to me. Well, the conditions are perfect. When I say conditions, Drew leans back and kisses me. So I press. There's still room on the sled, I say, pointing to the F inflexible flyer that is visible between Elise's legs. There's still room for another person. Who? Elise asks. Your little brother, Drew says, squeezing my knees. And that's about all that was said, sitting up there on 11th Avenue on Christmas Eve on a sled which is as old as my marriage, with a brake that is as old as my daughter. Later tonight, I will stand in my yard and throw this year's reindeer droppings on my very own home. I love Christmas. Now the snow spirals around us softly. I put my arms around my family and lift my feet under the steering bar. We begin to slip down H Street. We are trying for the record. The conditions, as you know by now, are perfect.
Ron Carlson's story called The H Street Sledding Record. It was read by the actor Tobin Atkinson, who is the artistic director of Meat and Potato Theater here in Salt Lake City. For years, Joseph Maiolo has been reading Truman Capote's classic story, A Christmas Memory, to crowds in Duluth, where he's a professor of English at the University of Minnesota. Maiolo says while In Cold Blood was Capote's masterpiece, A Christmas Memory is the high watermark of his short stories. Perhaps it's because it's so close to Capote's own life. Maiolo says it's the most autobiographical thing he ever wrote.
To me, it's a story that balances so well, sort of not sentimental. I don't like that word for this story. It uses sentiment, of course, but it does it with economy and with poetry. It has that cadence to it, and yet it seems to be told. This, you may know, is a story, and when I read it, of course, the female character will come alive right away in it. She, in real life, was named Souk Falk. She's not named in the story, and the little picture that he refers to in the story, taken by the Whistons, is the only picture they ever took, and it's on, I'm looking at it now. She is central, of course, to the story, and apparently was to his life as well. And it's very autobiographical, so much so that I don't think he ever drew the distinction.
Here, then, is Joseph Maiolo reading A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote.
Imagine a morning in late November, a coming of winter morning more than 20 years ago. Consider the kitchen of a spreading old house in a country town. A great black stove is its main feature. But there is also a big round table and a fireplace with two rocking chairs placed in front of it. Just today, the fireplace commenced its seasonal roar. A woman with shorn white hair is standing at the kitchen window. She is wearing tennis shoes and a shapeless gray sweater over a summery calico dress. She is small and sprightly, like a bantam hen, but due to a long youthful illness, her shoulders are pitifully hunched. Her face is remarkable, not unlike Lincoln's, craggy like that, and tinted by sun and wind. But it is delicate, too, finely boned, and her eyes are sherry-colored and timid. "Oh, my," she exclaims, her breath smoking the windowpane, "it's fruitcake weather." The person to whom she is speaking is myself. I am 7. She is 60-something. We are cousins, very distant ones, and we have lived together, well, as long as I can remember. Other people inhabit the house, relatives, and though they have power over us and frequently make us cry, we are not, on the whole, too much aware of them. We are each other's best friend. She calls me Buddy, in memory of a boy who was formerly her best friend. The other Buddy died in the 1880s, when she was still a child. She is still a child. "I knew it before I got out of bed," she says, turning away from the window with a purposeful excitement in her eyes. "The courthouse bell sounded so cold and clear, and there were no birds singing. They've gone to warmer country, yes, indeed. Oh, Buddy, stop stuffing biscuit and fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat. We've 30 cakes to bake." It's always the same. A morning arrives in November, and my friend, as though officially inaugurating the Christmas time of year that exhilarates her imagination and fuels the blaze of her heart, announces, "It's fruitcake weather. Fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat." The hat is found, a straw cartwheel corsaged with velvet roses out of doors has faded. It once belonged to a more fashionable relative. Together, we guide our buggy, a dilapidated baby carriage, out to the garden and into a grove of pecan trees. The buggy is mine. That is, it was bought for me when I was born. It is made of wicker, rather unraveled, and the wheels wobble like a drunkard's legs. But it is a faithful object. Springtimes we take it to the woods and fill it with flowers, herbs, wild fern for our porch pots. In the summer we pile it with picnic paraphernalia and sugarcane fishing poles and roll it down to the edge of a creek. It has its winter uses, too, as a truck for hauling firewood from the yard to the kitchen, as a warm bed for Queenie, our tough little orange and white rat terrier who has survived distemper and 2 rattlesnake bites. Queenie is trotting beside it now. 3 hours later, we are back in the kitchen hulling a heaping buggy load of windfall pecans. Our backs hurt from gathering them. How hard they were to find, the main crop having been shaken off the trees and sold by the orchard's owners, who are not us. Among the concealing leaves, the frosted, deceiving grass, crackle, a cheery crunch, scraps of miniature thunder sound as the shells collapse, and the golden mound of sweet, oily, ivory meat mounts in the milk glass bowl. Queenie begs to taste, and now and again my friend sneaks her a mite, though insisting we deprive ourselves. We mustn't, buddy. If we start, we won't stop. And there's scarcely enough as there is for 30 cakes. The kitchen is growing dark. Dusk turns the window into a mirror. Our reflections mingle with the rising moon as we work by the fireside in the firelight. At last, when the moon is quite high, we toss the final hull into the fire and, with joined sighs, watch it catch flame. The buggy is empty. The bowl is brimful. We eat our supper, cold biscuits, bacon, blackberry jam, and discuss tomorrow. Tomorrow, the kind of work I like best begins. Buying. Cherries and citron, ginger and vanilla, and canned Hawaiian pineapple, rinds and raisins and walnuts and whiskey and, oh, so much flour, butter, so many eggs, spices, flavorings. Why, we'll need a pony to pull the buggy home. But before these purchases can be made, there is the question of money. Neither of us has any. Except for skinflint sums persons in the house occasionally provide, a dime is considered very big money, or what we earn ourselves from various activities, holding rummage sales, selling buckets of hand-picked blackberries, jars of homemade jam and apple jelly and peach preserves, rounding up flowers for funerals and weddings. Once, we won 79th prize, $5, in a national football contest. Not that we know a fool thing about football. It's just that we enter any contest we hear about. At the moment, our hopes are centered on the $50,000 grand prize being offered to name a new brand of coffee. We suggested AM, and after some hesitation, for my friend thought it perhaps sacrilegious, the slogan, AM, Amen. To tell the truth, our only really profitable enterprise was the Fun and Freak Museum we conducted in a backyard woodshed 2 summers ago. The Fun was a stereopticon with slide views of Washington and New York, lent us by a relative who had been to those places. She was furious when she discovered why we'd borrowed it. The Freak was a three-legged bitty chicken hatched by one of our own hens. Everybody hereabouts wanted to see that bitty. We charged grown-ups a nickel, kids 2 cents, and took in a good $20 before the museum shut down due to the decease of the main attraction. But one way and another, we do each year accumulate Christmas savings, a fruitcake fund. These monies we keep hidden in an ancient bead purse, under a loose board, under the floor, under a chamber pot, under my friend's bed. The purse is seldom removed from the safe location except to make a deposit or, as happens every Saturday, a withdrawal. For on Saturdays, I am allowed 10 cents to go to the picture show. My friend has never been to a picture show, nor does she intend to. I'd rather hear you tell the story, buddy. That way I can imagine it more. Besides, a person my age shouldn't squander their eyes. When the Lord comes, let me see him clear. In addition to never having seen a movie, she has never eaten in a restaurant, traveled more than 5 miles from home, received or sent a telegram, read anything except funny papers and the Bible, worn cosmetics, cursed, wished someone harm, told a lie on purpose, let a hungry dog go hungry. Here are a few things she has done, does do. Killed with a hoe the biggest rattlesnake ever seen in this county, 16 rattles. Dip snuff, secretly. Tame hummingbirds, just try it, till they balance on her finger. Tell ghost stories, we both believe in ghosts. So tingling they chill you in July. talk to herself, take walks in the rain, grow the prettiest japonicas in town, know the recipe for every sort of old-time Indian cure, including a magical wart remover. Now, with supper finished, we retire to the room in a faraway part of the house where my friend sleeps in a scrap quilt-covered iron bed painted rose pink, her favorite color. Silently, wallowing in the pleasures of conspiracy, we take the bead purse from its secret place and spill its contents onto the scrap quilt. Dollar bills tightly rolled and green as May buds, somber 50-cent pieces, heavy enough to weight a dead man's eyes. Lovely dimes, the liveliest coin, the one that really jingles. Nickels and quarters worn smooth as creek pebbles, but mostly a hateful heap of bitter-odored pennies. Last summer, others in the house contracted to pay us a penny for every 25 flies we killed. Oh, the carnage of August, the flies that flew to heaven. Yet it was not work in which we took pride. And as we sit counting pennies, it is as though we were back tabulating dead flies. Neither of us has a head for figures. We count slowly, lose track, start again. According to her calculations, we have $12.73. According to mine, exactly $13. I do hope you're wrong, buddy. We can't mess around with 13. The cakes will fall or put somebody in the cemetery. Why, I wouldn't dream of getting out of bed on the 13th. This is true. She always spends 13ths in bed. So, to be on the safe side, we subtract a penny and toss it out the window. Of the ingredients that go into our fruitcakes, whiskey is the most expensive, as well as the hardest to obtain. State law forbids its sale. But everybody knows you can buy a bottle from Mr. Ha Ha Jones, and the next day, having completed our more prosaic shopping, we set out for Mr. Ha Ha's business address, a sinful, to quote public opinion, fish fry and dancing cafe down by the river. We've been there before and on the same errand. But in previous years, our dealings have been with Ha Ha's wife, an iodine, dark Indian woman with brassy peroxided hair and a dead-tired disposition. Actually, we've never laid eyes on her husband, though we've heard that he's an Indian too, a giant with razor scars across his cheeks. They call him Ha Ha because he's so gloomy, a man who never laughs. As we approach his cafe, a large log cabin festooned inside and out with chains of garish gay naked light bulbs, and standing by the river's muddy edge under the shade of river trees where moss drifts through the branches like gray mists, our steps slow down. Even Queenie stops prancing and sticks close by. People have been murdered in Ha Ha's cafe, cut to pieces, hit on the head. There's a case coming up in court next month. Naturally, these goings-on happen at night, when the colored lights cast crazy patterns and the Victrola wails. In the daytime, Ha Ha's is shabby and deserted. I knock at the door. Queenie barks. My friend calls. "Ms. Ha Ha, ma'am, anyone to home?" Footsteps. The door opens. Our hearts overturn. It's Mr. Ha Ha Jones himself, and he is a giant. He does have scars. He doesn't smile. No, he glowers at us through Satan-tilted eyes and demands to know what you want with Ha Ha. For a moment, we are too paralyzed to tell. Presently, my friend half finds her voice, a whispery voice at best. "If you please, Mr. Ha Ha, we'd like a quart of your finest whiskey." His eyes tilt more. Would you believe it? Ha Ha is smiling, laughing too. Which one of you's a drinking man? "It's for making fruitcakes, Mr. Ha Ha, cooking." This sobers him. He frowns. That's no way to waste good whiskey. Nevertheless, he retreats into the shadowed cafe and seconds later appears carrying a bottle of daisy yellow, unlabeled liquor. He demonstrates its sparkle in the sunlight and says, $2. We pay him with nickels and dimes and pennies. And suddenly, as he jangles the coins in his hand like a fistful of dice, his face softens. Tell you what, he proposes, pouring the money back into our bead purse. Just send me one of them fruitcakes instead. Well, my friend remarks on our way home, there's a lovely man. We'll put an extra cup of raisins in his cake. The black stove, stoked with coal and firewood, glows like a lighted pumpkin. Egg beaters whirl. Spoons spin round in bowls of butter and sugar. Vanilla sweetens the air. Ginger spices it. Melting, nose-tingling odors saturate the kitchen, suffuse the house, drift out to the world on puffs of chimney smoke. In 4 days, our work is done. 31 cakes, dampened with whiskey, bask on windowsills and shelves. Who are they for? Friends. Not necessarily neighbor friends. Indeed, the larger share is intended for persons we've met maybe once, perhaps not at all. People who've struck our fancy, like President Roosevelt, like the Reverend and Mrs. J.C. Lucy, Baptist missionaries to Borneo, who lectured here last winter, or the little knife grinder who comes through town twice a year, or Abner Packer, the driver of the 6 o'clock bus from Mobile, who exchanges waves with us every day as he passes in a dust cloud, whoosh, or the young Whistons, a California couple whose car one afternoon broke down outside the house and who spent a pleasant hour chatting with us on the porch. Young Mr. Whiston snapped our picture, the only one we've ever had taken. Is it because my friend is shy with everyone except strangers that these strangers and merest acquaintances seem to us our truest friends? I think yes. Also, the scrapbooks we keep of thank yous on White House stationery, time-to-time communications from California and Borneo, the knife grinder's penny postcards, make us feel connected to eventful worlds beyond the kitchen with its view of a sky that stops. Now, a nude December fig branch grates against the window. The kitchen is empty. The cakes are gone. Yesterday, we carted the last of them to the post office, where the cost of stamps turned our purse inside out. We're broke. That rather depresses me, but my friend insists on celebrating with 2 inches of whiskey left in Ha-Ha's bottle. Queenie has a spoonful and a bowl of coffee. She likes her coffee chicory-flavored and strong. The rest we divide between a pair of jelly glasses. We're both quite awed at the prospect of drinking straight whiskey. The taste of it brings screwed-up expressions and sour shudders. But by and by, we begin to sing, the two of us singing different songs simultaneously. I don't know the words to mine, just, come on along, to the dark town strutter's ball. But I can dance. That's what I mean to be, a tap dancer in the movies. My dancing shadow rollicks on the walls. Our voices rock the chinaware. We giggle, as if unseen hands were tickling us. Queenie rolls on her back. Her paws plow the air. Something like a grin stretches her black lips. Inside myself, I feel warm and sparky as those crumbling logs, carefree as the wind in the chimney. My friend waltzes round the stove, the hem of her poor calico skirt pinched between her fingers as though it were a party dress. Show me the way to go home, she sings, her tennis shoes squeaking on the floor. Show me the way to go home. Enter two relatives, very angry, potent with eyes that scold, tongues that scald. Listen to what they have to say, the words tumbling together into a wrathful tune. A child of 7, whiskey on his breath. Are you out of your mind, feeding a child of 7? Must be loony, road to ruination. Remember Cousin Kate, Uncle Charlie, Uncle Charlie's brother-in-law? Shame, scandal, humiliation. Kneel, pray, beg the Lord. Queenie sneaks under the stove. My friend gazes at her shoes. Her chin quivers. She lifts her skirt and blows her nose and runs to her room. Long after the town has gone to sleep and the house is silent except for the chimings of clocks and the sputter of fading fires, she is weeping into a pillow already as wet as a widow's handkerchief. "Don't cry," I say, sitting at the bottom of her bed and shivering despite my flannel nightgown that smells of last winter's cough syrup. "Don't cry," I beg, teasing her toes, tickling her feet. "You're too old for that." "It's because," she hiccups, "I am too old. Old and funny." "Not funny. Fun. More fun than anybody. Listen, if you don't stop crying, you'll be so tired tomorrow we can't go cut a tree." She straightens up. Queenie jumps on the bed, where Queenie is not allowed, to lick her cheeks. "I know where we'll find real pretty trees, buddy, and holly, too, with berries big as your eyes. It's way off in the woods, farther than we've ever been. Papa used to bring us Christmas trees from there, carry them on his shoulder. That's 50 years ago. Well, now, I can't wait for morning. Morning. Frozen rime lusters the grass. The sun, round as an orange, and orange as hot weather moons, balances on the horizon, burnishes the silvered winter woods. A wild turkey calls. A renegade hog grunts in the undergrowth. Soon, by the edge of knee-deep, rapid-running water, we have to abandon the buggy. Queenie wades the stream first, paddles across barking complaints at the swiftness of the current, the pneumonia-making coldness of it. We follow, holding our shoes and equipment, a hatchet, a burlap sack, above our heads. A mile more of chastising thorns, burrs and briars that catch at our clothes, of rusty pine needles brilliant with gaudy fungus and molted feathers. Here, there, a flash, a flutter, an ecstasy of shrillings remind us that not all the birds have flown south. Always the path unwinds through lemony sun pools and pitch-black vine tunnels. Another creek to cross. A disturbed armada of speckled trout froths the water round us, and frogs the size of plates practice belly flops. Beaver workmen are building a dam. On the farther shore, Queenie shakes herself and trembles. My friend shivers too, not with cold, but enthusiasm. One of her hat's ragged roses sheds a petal as she lifts her head and inhales the pine-heavy air. "We're almost there. Can you smell it, buddy?" she says, as though we were approaching an ocean. And indeed it is a kind of ocean. Scented acres of holiday trees, prickly-leafed holly, red berries shiny as Chinese bells. Black crows swoop upon them, screaming. Having stuffed our burlap sacks with enough greenery and crimson to garland a dozen windows, we set about choosing a tree. "It should be," muses my friend, "twice as tall as a boy, so a boy can't steal the star. The one we pick is twice as tall as me, a brave, handsome brute that survives 30 hatchet strokes before it keels with a creaking, rending cry. Lugging it like a kill, we commence the long trek out. Every few yards, we abandon the struggle, sit down, and pant. But we have the strength of triumphant huntsmen. That and the tree's virile, icy perfume revive us, goad us on. Many compliments accompany our sunset return along the red clay road to town, but my friend is sly and noncommittal when passers-by praise the treasure perched in our buggy. What a fine tree, and where did it come from? Yonder ways, she murmurs vaguely. Once a car stops and the rich mill owner's lazy wife leans out and whines, "Give you 2 bits cash for that old tree." Ordinarily, my friend is afraid of saying no, but on this occasion, she promptly shakes her head. "We wouldn't take a dollar." The mill owner's wife persists. "A dollar my foot, 50 cents. That's my last offer. Goodness, woman, you can get another one." In answer, my friend gently reflects, I doubt it. There's never two of anything. Home, Queenie slumps by the fire and sleeps till tomorrow, snoring loud as a human. A trunk in the attic contains a shoebox of ermine tails, off the opera cape of a curious lady who once rented a room in the house, coils of frazzled tinsel gone gold with age, one silver star, a brief rope of dilapidated, undoubtedly dangerous, candy-like light bulbs. Excellent decorations, as far as they go, which isn't far enough. My friend wants our tree to blaze like a Baptist window, droop with weighty snows of ornament. But we can't afford the made-in-Japan splendors at the five and dime. So we do what we've always done, sit for days at the kitchen table with scissors and crayons and stacks of colored paper. I make sketches, and my friend cuts them out. Lots of cats. Fish, too, because they're easy to draw. Some apples, some watermelons, a few winged angels devised from saved-up sheets of Hershey bar tinfoil. We use safety pins to attach these creations to the tree. As a final touch, we sprinkle the branches with shredded cotton, picked in August for this purpose. My friend, surveying the effect, clasps her hands together. Now, honest, buddy, doesn't it look good enough to eat? Queenie tries to eat an angel. After weaving and ribboning holly wreaths for all the front windows, our next project is the fashioning of family gifts. Tie-dye scarves for the ladies. For the men, a home-brewed lemon and licorice and aspirin syrup to be taken at the first symptoms of a cold and after hunting. But when it comes time for making each other's gift, my friend and I separate to work secretly. I would like to buy her a pearl-handled knife, a radio, a whole pound of chocolate-covered cherries. We tasted some once, and she always swears, I could live on them, buddy. Lord, yes, I could. And that's not taking his name in vain. Instead, I am building her a kite. She would like to give me a bicycle. She's said so on several million occasions. If only I could, buddy. It's bad enough in life to do without something you want. But confound it, what gets my goat is not being able to give somebody something you want them to have. Only one of these days I will, buddy, locate you a bike. Don't ask me how. Steal it, maybe. Instead, I'm fairly certain that she is building me a kite, the same as last year and the year before. The year before that, we exchanged slingshots. All of which is fine by me, for we are champion kite flyers who study the wind like sailors. My friend, more accomplished than I, can get a kite aloft when there isn't enough breeze to carry clouds. Christmas Eve afternoon, we scrape together a nickel and go to the butcher's to buy Queenie's traditional gift, a good, gnawable beef bone. The bone, wrapped in funny paper, is placed high in the tree near the silver star. Queenie knows it's there. She squats at the foot of the tree, staring up in a trance of greed. When bedtime arrives, she refuses to budge. Her excitement is equaled by my own. I kick the covers and turn my pillow as though it were a scorching summer's night. Somewhere a rooster crows, falsely, for the sun is still on the other side of the world. Buddy, are you awake? It is my friend calling from her room, which is next to mine, and an instant later she is sitting on my bed holding a candle. Well, I can't sleep a hoot, she declares. My mind's jumping like a jackrabbit. Buddy, do you think Ms. Roosevelt will serve our cake at dinner? We huddle in the bed, and she squeezes my hand. I love you. Seems like your hand used to be so much smaller. I guess I hate to see you grow up. When you're grown up, will we still be friends? I say, always. But I feel so bad, buddy. I wanted so bad to give you a bike. I tried to sell my cameo Papa gave me. Buddy, she hesitates, as though embarrassed. I made you another kite. Then I confess that I made her one, too, and we laugh. The candle burns too short to hold. Out it goes, exposing the starlight, the stars spinning on the window like a visible caroling that slowly, slowly daybreak silences. Possibly we doze, but the beginnings of dawn splash us like cold water. We're up, wide-eyed and wandering, while we wait for others to waken. Quite deliberately, my friend drops a kettle on the kitchen floor. I tap dance in front of closed doors. One by one, the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both. But it's Christmas, so they can't. First, a gorgeous breakfast, just everything you can imagine, from flapjacks and fried squirrel to hominy grits and honey in the comb, which puts everyone in a good humor, except my friend and me. Frankly, we're so impatient to get at the presents, we can't eat a mouthful. Well, I'm disappointed. Who wouldn't be? With socks, a Sunday school shirt, some handkerchiefs, a hand-me-down sweater, and a year's subscription to a religious magazine for children? The Little Shepherd, it makes me boil. It really does. My friend has a better haul. A sack of satsumas, that's her best present. She is proudest, however, of a white wool shawl knitted by her married sister. But she says her favorite gift is the kite I built her. And it is very beautiful, though not as beautiful as the one she made me, which is blue and scattered with gold and green good conduct stars. Moreover, my name is painted on it, Buddy. Buddy, the wind is blowing. The wind is blowing, and nothing will do till we've run to a pasture below the house where Queenie has scooted to bury her bone, and where, a winter hence, Queenie will be buried too. There, plunging through the healthy waist-high grass, we unreel our kites, feel them twitching at the string like skyfish as they swim into the wind. Satisfied, sun-warmed, we sprawl in the grass and peel satsumas and watch our kites cavort. Soon, I forget the socks and hand-me-down sweater. I'm as happy as if we'd already won the $50,000 grand prize in that coffee-naming contest. My, how foolish I am, my friend cries, suddenly alert, like a woman remembering too late she has biscuits in the oven. You know what I've always thought, she asks in a tone of discovery, and not smiling at me, but a point beyond. I've always thought a body would have to be sick and dying before they saw the Lord. And I imagined that when he came, it would be like looking at the Baptist window, pretty as colored glass, with the sun pouring through, such a shine you don't know it's getting dark. And it's been a comfort to think of that shine taking away all the spooky feeling. But I'll wager it never happens. I'll wager at the very end, a body realizes the Lord has already shown himself, that things as they are, her hand circles in a gesture that gathers clouds and kites and grass and Queenie pawing the earth over her bone. Just what they've always seen was seeing him. As for me, I could leave the world with today in my eyes. This is our last Christmas together. Life separates us. Those who know best decide that I belong in a military school. And so follows a miserable succession of bugle-blowing prisons, grim, reveille-ridden summer camps. I have a new home, too, but it doesn't count. Home is where my friend is, and there I never go. And there she remains, puttering around the kitchen. Alone with Queenie, then alone. Buddy dear, she writes in her wild, hard-to-read script, yesterday, Jim Macy's horse kicked Queenie bad. Be thankful she didn't feel much. I wrapped her in a fine linen sheet and rode her in the buggy down to Simpson's pasture, where she can be with all her bones. For a few Novembers, she continues to bake her fruitcake single-handed. Not as many, but some. And, of course, she always sends me the best of the batch. Also, in every letter, she encloses a dime wadded in toilet paper. See a picture show, and write me the story. But gradually in her letters, she tends to confuse me with her other friend, the buddy who died in the 1880s. More and more, 13ths are not the only days she stays in bed. A morning arrives in November, a leafless, birdless coming of winter morning, when she cannot rouse herself to exclaim, "Oh my, it's fruitcake weather." And when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein had already received, severing from me an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across a school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying toward heaven.
Truman Capote's story, it's called A Christmas Memory. Joseph Maiolo is an English professor at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Happy holidays, everyone.